This is episode number 778 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to give a recap of Broadbrook Comic-Con, talk about the Metallica show that Matt and I went to, as well as the Aspen Humble Bundle. Our comics this week will be Royals number 1, Archie number 20, and Super Sons number 2. And our summer reading project, The Summer of Dread, kicks off this week with the first portion of the Judge Dredd case files.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
God, clean the whole fun.
And welcome, everybody, to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the talented, the beautiful, the rocking out Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well. Trying to recover from work. We have nobody at our building. We're redoing our building, so we have no work going on right now.
Yep.
They don't want to lay anybody off because they want everybody to be fresh and ready to go. But that means I have to do 40 hours of classroom with my people. So as
Oh, this is when you guys get your training in and stuff
so
like that.
So I'm doing all the training. Yep. I'm making training up as I go along.
Yeah.
And yesterday I came home with no voice. Tuesday was softball. I thought I broke my thumb, but I think I just smashed it up a little bit.
It looks a little less swollen than when I saw you. Was it last night?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The knee hurts. The foot hurts.
And so, we've got some good rain going outside, which kicks up those aches and pains for the old man bones. Yep. Yeah.
So I hate to say today in the next episode, I might be mailing it in a little bit because I'm going to be sitting there kind of quiet.
It's like that poem about Jesus in the sand with the one set of footprints.
Yes.
I got this. Okay.
I've got this. You are Jesus is what you're saying.
I will carry you in this show. I'm not saying I'm Jesus. I do have a pretty great beard, but
you do.
Let's not go that far.
Yep.
The one thing I want to mention, even though people are not always fond of us kicking off things with the Music Minute, is that you and I had a chance to go see Metallica in concert at Gillette Stadium on the 19th, which was this past Friday as we record the following Thursday. And what was cool about that for me is that I got to bring Parker. And the other thing, too, is you and I have never seen Metallica together. We've seen plenty of bands together.
Yeah.
Never seen Metallica together. I had not seen Metallica since 1989. March of 1989.
88, the summer before.
Yes. So I saw them in March of 89. It was the Injustice for All tour. I saw them at the Hartford Civic Center with Queensryche. Queensryche was on their Operation Mindcrime tour. And so it had been so long. And what I was kind of blown away by is how good they still sound in concert. Like, James Hetfield's voice still sounds great. They put on a wonderful stage show. They are super professional, but also very interactive with the crowd. And it was at Gillette Stadium, which I checked online to see how many it holds. It holds 66,000.
Yeah.
Now, the stadium's only about 80% open because the stage is in one of the end zones, basically.
Yep.
So you figure, I'm just going to say conservatively, that they had a minimum of 30,000 people there.
I would even think more than that because you're counting seats.
Right.
But you also have all the people that were on the floor.
Right.
And that floor was stage to the other end.
And they
zone.
Literally put floor down. They put floor panels over the turf.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a hard floor that people are standing on there. But it was just an absolute humongous crowd there. And for my son, who has been now to several shows over the past, I would say, 16 months or so, is when I started really taking him to shows. This was by far the biggest show that we had taken him to. And with Metallica stage show with flames shooting out of the stage and stuff like that, like, he was pretty blown away by that. And what was awesome is that people were like high-fiving him and everything because he was obviously he's, you know, going on 11 years old.
Younger than your average fan.
Pretty young kid. Although I will say I saw a surprising number of kids there overall, but it was awesome to, he gets like the celebrity treatment when he goes to shows because people are psyched that. I think metal fans worry that we as a sort of a breed are who is coming up behind us, you know, especially old school metal fans. And so people get very excited when metal fans start bringing their kids to shows and they can sort of see that torch being passed and the next generation coming up, they get really excited about that. I get excited about that.
I do too.
I see, you know, families come together and stuff like that. And in fact, we were sitting next to a family on our right-hand side in the seats that we were in. There was a family there, and it was like a mother, father, and two kids that were there watching the show. And the kids were teenagers, and it was really cool. And then to my left was a guy who came by himself.
Yep.
And Parker had just asked me, like, Dad, do you ever go to concerts by yourself? I turn around, this guy's there by himself. I started talking to this guy, and it was awesome. You just, like, you just make friends immediately at concerts like that. And it was just super awesome. And the coolest thing I thought, outside of the show itself, is that Metallica records every single one of their live shows, and within a few days, you can actually purchase for $10,
which is not bad,
a download of the entire show, which equals out to be a two-disc set in about 2 hours and 20 minutes total that they played, which is a long, that's a good long show, for $10. And the quality is amazing. Yeah. Like, as soon as I saw that you could get that off of Metallica's website, my immediate thought was, how does every band not do this? Because I would buy, whether it was good or bad, I would buy every single concert that I went to live. If I had the option of purchasing a recording of that concert, I would buy every single show that I've ever gone to.
And it was interesting because you and I talked about that on the way out when we were walking back to our car.
Yep.
We were talking about the fact that wouldn't it be great to get a copy of, if maybe you couldn't get the exact show you were at, but if you had a audio record of every concert you ever went
to. Right?
That would be the coolest thing ever.
And the cool thing is now that, like, you can go on YouTube and there are a lot of people over the years who have uploaded the shows that they went through. I was able to go onto YouTube and find almost all of the show that I saw in Hartford in 1989.
Yeah.
People had uploaded video of different songs over the years, and it brought back a lot of memories of that particular time. So, yeah, so there you go. That's your Music Minute. That was really cool. Also this weekend on Sunday, unfortunately, you were working, Matthew, but I got to go to Broadbrook Comic-Con in Broadbrook, Connecticut, the first Broadbrook Comic-Con, which was put together by our buddy Jim Taylor.
Yep.
And at that show, G. Michael Dobbs was there. Our good friend Ron Leary was there. Our friend Aaron Wood was there. And Cesar Feliciano was there as well. And it was a nice, it was a fun afternoon. It was a great local show. I got to hang out and talk about music, as usual, with people. I am the worst seller of anything that I make myself. But talk to me about music or horror movies all day. All freaking day. I had no voice by the time that I left there, and I sold like a couple of books.
Yeah.
But all day I was talking about music, talking about it was super fun. So that show, Jim said he believes, is already a go for next year.
Excellent.
So that's going to be coming back again next year. So it's always good to see a local show do well and be able to jump back.
Especially a local show in my hometown.
Absolutely.
I grew up 2 miles from where that show was.
I know,
was,
and you couldn't be there, which was so sad.
Yeah.
Speaking of sad, we'll do this one next, and then we'll finish with some more positive stuff. I don't know if you heard this week, Matthew, but and this comes to us from Collider. In an incredibly tragic situation, a change is being made behind the scenes on Warner Brothers' next DC film, Justice League. Currently in post-production, the film was scheduled to undergo some reshoots this summer, which is par for the course in the blockbuster world. But due to a personal tragedy, Zack Snyder is now stepping away from the film. Sadly, the Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman Dawn of Justice's daughter committed suicide this past March. And while Snyder initially planned to dig back into the work, he's now decided to spend the time healing with his family. Per The Hollywood Reporter, the Avengers filmmaker Joss Whedon, who recently signed on to write and direct a post-production, write and direct a Batgirl movie in the DCU, is now stepping in to help oversee the completion of post-production on Justice League and to direct the reshoots. Now, apparently he had been brought on to write some of the stuff for the reshoots, but Snyder was going to direct that. And so now he will be directing that stuff as well. Zach said, in my mind, I thought it was cathartic. It was a cathartic thing to go back to work just to bury myself and see if that was the way through it, says an emotional Snyder in an interview Monday. The demands of this job are pretty intense. It is all consuming. And in the last 2 months, I've come to the realization I've decided to take a step back from the movie to be with my family, to be with my kids who really need me. They are all having a hard time. I'm having a hard time. Warner Brothers offered to push back the release date of the film, but the Snyders declined, opting instead to let another filmmaker come in and help bring this thing home. Warner Brothers has also extended Snyder's first look deal to give him more time to work on other planned projects when he decides to return to work. And let's see, Toby Emmerich, who is the Warner Brothers Pictures president, said, "The directing is minimal and it has to adhere to the style and tone and the template that Zack set. We're not introducing any new characters. It's the same characters and some new scenes. He's handing a baton to Joss, but of course, the course has really been set by Zack." So I think that he added that. I think that the guy from Warner Brothers added that because, of course, when you talk about Justice League and you talk about the tone of the DC universe and then you talk about some of the stuff that Whedon has done, I think some people thought a little bit too much of this move, that it would, that Whedon was going to come in and have some profound impact on the tone of the movie or the direction of the movie. He's literally just coming in to do these reshoots, and it is going to stick with whatever has already been set in place by Snyder in the time that he had spent with the movie. So, but the whole thing is just an awful, terrible tragedy. I mean, the fact that, and he went on to say in another interview that he had intended this not even to be public at all.
Yeah.
But because he ended up feeling like he needed to take a step back, he knew that people would start to speculate, which of course they would have. Can you imagine if they didn't say why he stepped back? I mean, the internet would have just blown up with, oh, he got taken off the movie and they brought Joss Whedon in and blah, blah, blah. But man, thoughts and prayers to his family and to their extended family and their friends and everything else, because that is, that's devastating to deal with.
Yeah, it's when I read that, they did do a very good job keeping that all private because I didn't know anything about it. And if you've never gone through that or had people that you care about go through it, a suicide is the worst thing. I mean, it's awful losing a child, but when you lose a child to suicide, it is speculation in your own head about what I could have done, what would I do wrong. And, you know, kudos to Zach for looking in the mirror and saying, you know what, I can't do this. I need to be with my family. And you're talking about walking away from arguably the most anticipated movie release in the next year or two. And he's saying, my family's more important right now. I'm more important. And I love that. I love to hear the fact that, you know, Warner Entertainment said, you know what, do whatever you got to do. We will rework all the deadlines for your deal that you have with us. We'll make this work. And I really think that that is a nice thing to do too, because again, it going through a tragedy of anything like that, you've got all the family stuff that you need to work on and worry about. Forget about the work side of your life.
Right.
I mean, I remember having a friend lose a child, and I remember my first thought was, did he call into work to tell people that, hey, I can't come in because this happened? And that was my first thought, because that's something I could never do that. I could never call up and say, hey, I can't come to work because my child passed away. I can't even imagine that. So I'm glad that that story came out for that particular reason, because I would not want anything to happen like you said. And everybody's like, oh, Snyder's out, Whedon's in, because they want it to feel more like a Marvel movie. And then he's got to be dealing with all that stuff too. So glad that it was said. Prayers and thoughts, like you said.
Yeah, I think that was a pretty big move of Warner Brothers in support of him to say that we will actually push back the date of, as you just said, our biggest movie in years or perhaps 4 years to come in order to, you know, make sure that you have time to do whatever you need to do. And, you know, the fact that he said, no, you guys need to go ahead and sort of make this thing happen, that's you got to have a lot of respect for both sides in that, for
and
sure.
I think it's definitely changed my feel about how I've always looked at Zack Snyder. Never personally, because I don't know him personally, but that really makes me look at his work a little bit more differently when you realize the person.
I mean, it also underlines what Warner Brothers thinks of him.
Yeah. Yep.
Because they, again, you don't usually see studios say, we'll push that back.
Yeah.
Can you imagine like that?
It's a cookie cutter world. Next.
Right.
Bring in the next guy. Next.
Well, plus from a financial standpoint, like they've already built in the projected returns on that movie into whatever quarter that that movie is launching in. So to have to push that and to take a loss in a quarter or something like that, that's huge. So.
And costs a lot of money. As silly as this sounds, when you think about all the posters that have gone out with that release date on it, every bit of thing that has a release date on it. Now you've got to go back and fix it. That takes time and money.
Right.
So.
I mean, it's like a house of cards, the, you know, the tentpole movie release schedule, and especially when you have a connected universe like they do, and they're trying to build, and they're in the early stages of that. So, yeah, man. Which on a positive note, Wonder Woman comes out this weekend.
Very excited.
And I cannot wait to see Wonder Woman, and I'm very encouraged. I haven't read any spoilers about the movie. I just saw online that the initial reactions were very positive.
So and I was chatting with Phil Jimenez, who is going to the world premiere.
He couldn't. I think he got. I saw that, or maybe it was Gail Simone. It was either him or Gail Simone that got invited to the screening that with DC employees and couldn't make it.
It might have been Gail. It might have been Gail because Phil was fired up.
Yeah.
And
well, he should be.
I told Phil, I said, you know the story, man. You brought me into the world of Wonder Woman.
Yeah. So there you go. Also in positive news, we got a couple of things going on here. The Humble Bundle I've talked about before on this show is usually a collection of digital goods where you can pay as little as you want to unlock certain content and pay more to unlock a whole bunch more content at a huge discount in order to support some good causes. Well, Humble Bundle, the pay what you want charity fundraising website, is partnering with Aspen Comics to offer fans a special curated assortment of the publisher's comics. This time around, fans will receive a host of Aspen's flagship offerings by the late superstar creator, including Michael, this is a Michael Turner bundle, I should mention, Michael Turner's Fathom and Soulfire, Executive Assistant Iris, and a special incentive cover to receive a free physical copy of the Aspen Store exclusive Harley Quinn #1 variant cover, which can only be purchased through the charity bundle.
Mm.
So, which is cool because I would imagine they have to get DC on board to do something like that. Customers can pay what they want by naming their own price of $1 or more, and can also choose how the money is allocated between Humble Bundle, which is the company that pulls it all together, Aspen, and two charity partners, the Hero Initiative, which we talk about frequently on the show, and the Prevent Cancer Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to choose when you go in and pay. Let's say you decide I'm going to pay $10. What of that $10 goes to who is up to you. That's how Humble Bundle works, which is pretty awesome. You could decide to send it all to one particular charity. Customers can pay $1 or more to receive Executive Assistant Iris Omnibus #1, Michael Turner's Fathom Omnibus #1, Michael Turner's Soulfire Omnibus #1, Michael Turner's Fathom Kiani Omnibus, Art of Aspen Comics Omnibus #1, Shrugged Volume 1, Aspen Sourcebooks Omnibus #1, and Aspen Seasons Omnibus #1. Now, I'm not familiar with each and every one of those products, Matthew, but my understanding is when you put the word omnibus in a title, that generally means that that is a fairly large collection.
Yep, and with Aspen, you are getting one of the best books that came out.
Right.
I love that book when it was released. I loved it so much that every time they did 15 different covers, I bought them. Just because I loved him. I was a huge fan of Michael Turner. Still love his art. It still saddens me that we never will see his work again.
Yep.
Just a tragic loss there. But that is worth whatever you're going to pay just for Aspen. Soulfire alone is really good. But Aspen, just brilliant stuff.
If you pay $8 or more, you get like the volume 2 omnibuses of all that stuff and a bunch of other stuff too. And if you pay $15 or more, you get everything and the Harley Quinn #1 exclusive cover. And what they usually do over the course of the time that they're going to have this out, which is for a couple of weeks, and I'll put a link in the show notes, is you will also get whatever issues they add to the bundle over the next couple of weeks, because they usually add a few things as well. So, and again, you can choose where your money goes in that particular purchase. So, I mean, again, whether you want to support the Hero Initiative, the Prevent Cancer Foundation, and throw a little money Aspen's way and support Humble Bundle, like all good stuff right there. So that's our news for the week. Oh, and one last piece of news, exciting news. The Warlock 5 Kickstarter was funded.
Very good.
It was $15,000, I believe they were looking for. And with, as we record today, there's a little less than 24 hours to go. They hit their goal yesterday.
This is
Cullen Bunn, Jimmy Johnston, Jeffrey Edwards, Andy Poole. And it is a sort of a new continuation of the 1980s sci-fi series that we talked about either in the last episode or the episode before. And if you haven't listened to that Jeffrey Edwards interview yet, you should go back and check that out. That got funded. And so that was really cool. And there was a lot of extra incentives added for people who have pledged already to it that you'll get in digital comic form once that thing gets finalized. So that's really good news. And we also had a piece of feedback this week. Our friend Ian Matthew. He said, so I was listening to the latest episode of SI, as I do, the Milkman, you might know from the message boards.
I remember Ian.
As I do for the last 10 years or so. And I was just thinking about how lucky Mattman is to have a dude in his life that would give him such platitudes every week. It got me to thinking, how would some of the people I see every week introduce me in a podcast? Here's a few. His coworkers would say, the punctual, the standoffish, the quiet. He said the fellas at Thursday Night Hoops would say, the cocky, the smack-talking, the old. His parents would say, the exasperating, the tiring, the I'm so glad he's out of my house. His friends would say, the cocky, the self-absorbed, the always late. His kids would say, the embarrassing, the out of touch, the I can't even cook pancakes without burning them. And his wife would say, the inconsiderate, the cocky, and something else I'm not going to mention on the show. He says, as you can see, not exactly the same ringing endorsements. I've been called cocky a few times in my life. You tell Mattman he's a lucky dude to have that in his life every week. As you can see, it could be a lot worse. Keep it up, fellas. Love it. We appreciate that email, yeah. Ian, and we also appreciate the fact that you have been with Secret Identity from pretty much the beginning.
Absolutely.
And have stuck with us all this time to hear all of those platitudes and to hear us blabber on every single week. We really appreciate that. And you know what else I appreciate, Matthew? Beard products.
Yes, you do.
Now, I'm running extremely low on my Viking oils.
Yep.
To the point where I am now having to unscrew the top off of the bottle and pour what remaining drops of beard oil are left into my hand in the morning to take care of my beard. But I'm surviving.
Yes.
I'm holding out for the next shipment of Viking oils because you don't have to hold out. Gentle listener, you can go to VikingOilsLLC.com and you can check out the new seasonal beard products from Viking Oils, which I will hopefully be getting my hands on soon, because once you start using them, it's like the stuff. You can't get enough.
Can't get enough of that wonderful stuff.
You can't get enough, Matthew. So go to VikingOilsLLC.com and check that out. They have been keeping my beard glowing for quite some time. I actually started using the beard balm a little bit now, and I don't know if I'm using it right. So it's like waxy.
Yes.
Right. So you take it and you sort of warm it up in your hand, and then you sort of comb it through the beard, and then you can shape it however you want, right? Am I doing that right?
That's exactly what I do with mine.
That's excellent. Okay. Then I am using that correctly.
Yep. Although you have a lot more than I do.
You know, what I got to be careful about now is, because I shaved the sides and I started shaving, you know, underneath a little bit, is that I don't go too high with the razor, because then I'm clipping some of the hairs out of there.
Yes.
And they took so long to grow. You don't want to waste them.
I like it like that. I like it how you have it starting to come up the neck a little bit.
Yep. I'm going to keep it this way for a little while and we'll go from there. So when we get the new shipment of Viking Rolls in, I will talk about the new seasonal products that they have, and we will get into that a little bit more. But what we're going to get into now, Matthew, is our comics for this week. And I will freely admit to you that I have been behind in my reading, like astronomically behind in my reading. I have about 7 issues of The Flash to catch up on.
Wow.
Yeah. Those DC ones that were shipping twice a month.
Yes.
I have, like, man, it was like we were running a marathon. I fell down and the pack just left without me.
And stepped on you on the way over.
Yeah, and I've been picking up, you know, most of the ones that I was enjoying, I've been picking up. But I'm a few issues behind on Deathstroke, several issues behind on Flash, several issues behind on Green Arrow, several issues behind on Superman. There is one that I've been catching up on that I'll talk about today. But I've been trying to make my way back. A series that I am now just jumping on after we talked about the sort of one-off a few weeks ago is Royals. This is the Inhuman book that picks up with the royal family of Inhumans now that they have sort of stepped down. And I believe it was Inhumans Prime that we talked about, where Medusa essentially said, you know, now that the Terrigen Mist is gone and now that there will never be a new crop of Inhumans to come along, we are stepping down from the throne. And she turned the temporary throne over to ISO, who I believe is a newer Inhuman, until they could put some sort of government in place. And so the royal family is kind of figuring out, well, what are we going to do with ourselves now? And at the end of that Inhumans Prime event, you had Marvel Boy, who showed up, who is from another dimension, and he said something cryptic to them about maybe the whole no more Inhumans thing is not as final as you guys think it is. I might know something that could help you. And so as we start off in this issue number one, which picks up right after that Inhumans Prime thing, and this series is written by Al Ewing. John Boy Myers does the art here. Ryan Kinnard does the colors. Clayton Coles does the letters. And John Boy Myers is the cover artist. And the editor on this one is Will Moss. And Tom Brevoort is the executive editor, obviously. So we start off 5,000 years from now, Matthew.
5,000.
Little jump into the future where you have basically flying dinosaurs, and it's talking about how dawn rises over Arctolan, which I guess is some future version of Atalan. And you have this sort of dragon rider who is flying along to this sort of some sort of residential structure up in the mountains, and he lands and a lone figure walks out to him, and you see that that lone figure is a very aged Black Bolt. So it's 5,000 years in the future, and it looks like Black Bolt is the only one left standing. And this figure is being given a ride by this dragon rider to kind of an old temple where he is recording the history of the Inhumans. So it kind of looks like that in the future, Black Bolt is the one who is tasked with keeping the history of the Inhumans and archiving it and sort of writing it down. And you can see that he is speaking in this temple. And as he's speaking, words are being carved into stone. And so that's sort of the prologue that you get here. Then we go to the current time in the Marvel Universe. And you see that in the current time, the Inhuman family, the royal family, is going out and finding the last of the Inhumans that have hatched from their cocoons. And as they start out, you have this Inhuman who looks like a giant version of Slimer that is sort of terrorizing a city. And apparently it was an old woman who she went into the cocoon in her basement, and she was in the cocoon for like 3 months. And so when most of the Inhumans that have hatched have already been out there in the world, she just kind of rose out of it, and she's in a frenzy. She's kind of like a giant monster. And so they arrive on the scene, and they don't want anybody to hurt her. They want to bring her down peacefully because they know that she's just waking up to these new abilities and this new power, and she doesn't even know what to do with themselves. So you see Medusa there. You see Gorgon there. You see who else is there? You have Flint. You have ISO. Those two particular Inhumans are, I don't know if they're romantically involved, but they have a very close relationship. So they show up, and they're able to basically subdue this Inhuman woman without hurting her. And so they do that. And as that's happening, you have up above New Atalan, you have coming down Marvel Boy. And he shows up to New Atalan, and he's saying, "My name is Novar. Most humans call me Marvel Boy." And he gives a brief history of himself. And he's saying, I'm from a place where the Kree solved everything, including your problems. And I know something you don't know in humans. I know a secret." And so you have ISO, who's sitting there on the throne, and Medusa standing next to her now, which is kind of a stark contrast to what you're used to. And Black Bolt standing there in silence. And he's like, "I don't want to get your hopes up too soon for now. Let's just say it's the secret behind all secrets, the secret of who you are." And ISO's like, "We know who we are. We know what's going on." And he's like, no. "You know who you were." He said, "But all this stuff about, you know, you guys trying to save the Terrigen and then fighting with the X-Men and doing all that stuff, that didn't work out so great for you. But I believe that the secret to the future of the Inhumans is held on the Kree homeworld of Hala." Now, apparently Hala was destroyed, which is what the Inhumans say to him. Like, that doesn't even exist anymore. And he's like, "Well, I think what we're looking for and the secret that I know about is still out there, and I think we need to go out into space to where the Kree homeworld was, and we need to find it." And so Medusa pretty much says, "Look, if this is a chance that we have to somehow figure out a future for the Inhumans, then I have to go, and I'll go by myself if I have to." And then Gorgon's like, of course, you're not going to have to go alone. And Crystal's like, absolutely, we'll go with you. So pretty much the whole royal family is deciding that they're going to go on this trip and they're going to team up with Marvel Boy. They're going to go into space and they're going to find out what's going on. And then most of the issue becomes the people that have chosen to go saying goodbye to the people that are left behind. So you have Captain Swain, who's a new Inhuman, but she's a pilot. She's a spaceship pilot. She's there and she's saying goodbye to, I forget, Ash, I believe is the other Inhuman's name, who I think they kind of have a budding relationship. You have Flint and Iso. And Iso is back as sort of the temporary ruler of the Inhumans, and Flint decides that he's going to go because he feels like he owes it to the Inhumans to, you know, help them find a future. You have Crystal, who's saying goodbye to Luna, her daughter. Gorgon is saying goodbye to his son. And then you have Medusa, who is trying to talk to Black Bolt about what's been going on between them. Because if you remember, like, she was with Johnny Storm for a while. Mm-hmm. And all this – and I don't really understand where the conversation happened, where the two of them – are either back together or they're still separated, but they're going to hang out together. Like, I don't understand what's going on with them, but she tries to have a conversation with him, ironically. And he's not even responding to her in the nonverbal way that she is used to. Apparently, whatever Maximus said to him, because that happened in the Inhumans Prime issue, Maximus said something to him that basically kind of shook him to the core. And whatever that was, he's still reeling from that. So he's kind of been almost a background character at this point in time, but the starship Asterion is the ship that they leave on, and the first issue of this series ends with them heading out from New Adelan and basically heading out to space to try and figure out, is there a solution to this Terrigen problem that they have? And as they head out, you have Medusa, who is thinking about the fact that she's been feeling really tired lately, and she doesn't know if it's because, you know, the weight of the leadership has been on her, or if, you know, their time as a royal family and stepping down now, this transition is happening. But she's been feeling like there's something sort of kind of sapping her a little bit. And as she's sitting there, she runs her fingers through her hair, and part of her hair starts to break off. And that's when she realizes that she's dying. Mm. And so the issue sort of ends with her telling, or at least saying out loud on this ship as they're leaving New Adelan and heading out into space, I'm dying. And that's how it ends. And then in the back page, you get Al Ewing basically talking about what some of the core ideas were for this series and what they want to do with it. And basically said the pitch line, as soon as I, you know, was thinking about the Inhumans, was they're going to go to space. That's what I want to do with this. And so a pretty cool first issue of Royals. It's a small enough cast, I think, where you can jump into this book and you don't need to know everybody. The new Inhumans that are in there are pretty easy to figure out, and it seems like it's going to be small enough in terms of cast where you can sort of jump in and follow along. The other thing that's going on in that book is that Marvel Boy has some ulterior motive, and we don't know what it is yet, but it's kind of cryptically. It almost looks like he has a connection to the Kree Supreme Intelligence, because he has this little canister with what looks like a head or a face inside of it. And I think that's the Kree Supreme Intelligence. And so we'll see what happens with that. I'm hoping that this kind of taps into some of the cosmic stuff that the Abnett and Lanning runs of the Annihilation stuff was doing. So if it is going to, then this is a book that I'm absolutely going to be following for sure.
And isn't John Boy Meyer's art great?
It's fantastic.
I love his art. He's such a cool guy. And I remember him, we were talking one time online, and he was telling me, because I was like, dude, you're on Teen Titans. This is great. Well, I'm only on it for a couple issues. And he couldn't talk about what the project was he was moving to, and apparently it was this.
Yeah, I mean, you can see this. Nobody else can. But you, like, his panel work is very sort of dynamic, especially in the big action scenes. He's good at drawing the quieter moments as well. And he really fills the panel with a lot of action. So it's got a little bit of everything, and if you like the Inhumans or at least want to see what this incarnation of them is going to do in the Marvel U, it's worth checking out.
Yep. So the next book we're going to talk about is bringing everything back to Earth a lot, and that is Archie number 20 in a series called Over the Edge. Now, this is going to either be a 3 or 4-parter where something major is going to happen to one of the Archie characters,
which they've been teasing for a while.
Yes, and it's written by Mark Waid and lovingly drawn by Pete Woods. I love Pete Woods' art. When he was drawing Robin – that to me was the definitive look of that book. And to see him on Archie is just great to have. So we start out with Archie hanging from a tree, and he's talking about the only person that really seems to hate him and he doesn't get along with is Reggie Mantle. And as he is holding onto a tree, you see above it, Reggie's there with a saw, sawing the branch that he's hanging on. So he's narrating the story saying, you know, I firmly believe that Archie's got to be one of the meanest people that ever lived. He is somebody that likes to play jokes on people. And as the time has gone on, the jokes have just gotten worse and worse and more mean-spirited. And you see him, like, Archie's carrying a couple boxes, and you see Reggie throw a banana peel underneath his foot.
Let's also not forget, it's Reggie's fault that the whole zombie apocalypse happens as well.
Yeah, so Reggie's always been a jerk.
Yeah.
We're just seeing what a jerk he is. You have Archie standing up against his car, and as he's talking about how the things are just getting worse and worse, and sometimes he goes too far, he's spray painting on Archie's car, "Eat a Giant," and you don't see what he's writing, but the G and the I are now across Archie's legs because he's standing in front of the car. Then he says, you know, this isn't any normal day for Reggie. And then you see the next one, you got a bunch of little kids playing in a sandbox, and he's walking up with a hose ready to hose them all down and make the water and the
sand
in the mud.
What's that dude's problem?
Got a serious problem. So the next chapter, and what I love about these books is that they break them up into chapters, and the chapters may only be 3 or 4 pages, but it's really cool to see that. So you have Betty underneath the car. It's a Mustang underneath the car. I believe it's a – no, it's a Cobra. He's underneath the car – or talking about a car that he got when he was a little kid, and that the uncle – he's like, oh, yeah, my uncle – left me this car that I could always – that said I could always have it when I was older. And you see him and Betty there as little kids. And he goes, but he didn't really so much give it to me as he abandoned it and just left it in the yard. So you see Betty underneath it working on it, asking Archie for a 3/8 wrench, and he hands her something else and it's the wrong size. She throws it back at him. Veronica comes walking up and they start talking. And this is, again, as Veronica just came back from being away, so her and Archie's relationship isn't necessarily as strong as it should be. And she's talking about this new car, and he's talking to her about the car, and Betty comes out from underneath it saying, hey, we only got a little bit further to go. Can you go get the new battery out of the garage? So Archie goes in and gets the battery, and as they're talking about the battery, he steps on something and gets electrocuted. And you see him just standing there with smoke coming off of him. And she says, you know, Betty's trying to explain to Veronica why you don't just abandon a car like this and go buy a new one. You build this one up. So they get it all set up. They get in it. They start driving. And then as soon as he floors it, or Betty floors it, you hear knock, 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 knock. And then she goes, Archie, did you remember to put gas in the gas tank? Now you turn the page and you go to Cheryl and Jason Blossom, who are in a small room in a small house. Now, their family in this one had just lost their fortune. And they have also found out, they found a letter that the father that they thought was their father is not their father, that their father is somebody else. And, you know, he's like, look, I can't believe that this happened. You know, the kids think we're poor and all this stuff's going on, but we can't explain to them what is going on. And he's saying, you know, I can't believe the looks of betrayal on their faces. It's the fact that all of a sudden they think that they know that I'm not their father. And the mother saying, look, you've raised these kids. You're their father. And it's interesting because the mother, the father, Cheryl and Jason all have the red hair, even though this might be a stepfather or adopted or whatever it is. So there's something interesting going on with that one as well. Now you go back and you have Betty going through the car again and saying, well, I guess it wasn't your fault, so I can't blame you. Because there was gas in it, but who forgot to check the fuel line? So all of a sudden, a speedy new car pulls up, and it's Reggie. And Reggie pulls up with a friend of his, and Betty's underneath the hood. And he's like, you know, let's take a look at the body. And he's staring at Betty. And then he pushes him back, says, you need to shut up. And they're going on, and then he's looking at Archie going, hey, don't forget what Coach said. The next time you fumble a football, you're off the team. And that's just pissing him off more and more and more. And he goes, you know what? I kind of respect the fact that you've built this new car out of garbage. So what I want to do is I want to see how fast it is. Why don't you and I race? We'll go up and we'll race for pink slips. And he's like, look, I'm not going to do that. And then Reggie's like, all right, you're chicken, buck, buck, buck. Little Archie's a chicken. And then he forces Archie to do it and go into it. Now, in the next chapter, they're trying to make the car go a little bit faster. Betty's in there trying to do things. Dilton is there trying to add his scientific knowledge to everything. And as they get ready to go, she doesn't realize that he is going to race it, and she gets all bent out of shape. Reggie's friend pulls up and says, "Hey, your buddy's about to lose that car that you were building." So she gets all upset, and she's like, "What are you doing?" She gets in her family car, drives up, and as she drives up, the race is already getting ready to go, and it's that typical old school drag race down Dead Man's Curve, where the road goes straight and it curves. As Betty is showing up to try to stop the race, she is now coming face on with the two of them racing. He sees Betty. He slams on the brakes. The car goes skidding into an oil slick. And then those two cars, Archie and Reggie's cars crash into each other, hit Betty's car head on. And you see everybody watching this going, oh, no, this isn't good. And then you see the last page I'll show you, Brian, of the guardrail broken and flames and smoke coming up. And they're saying they all went right through the guardrail, and that is to be continued. And then in the next ad, it says, "Over the Edge, the three-part epic. Over the Edge has begun, and one of Archie's friends will be forever changed." And you have a stamp over Archie. It's got Archie, Betty, Jughead, Veronica, and Reggie. And Reggie's got a stamp on that says safe. So we know he's safe.
Interesting.
So you have something else right there. You also get a little preview of the Archie's one-shot. The Archies is the band that Archie's in, and I can't wait for that one because that one looks really good. So if you are looking to maybe enjoy some comics after watching Riverdale and the season-ending spectacular, you should check this out, because although it is not necessarily the same exact thing, the characters are the same, and you get that same feel.
Awesome. Well, I am going to not stick in the Archie universe, Matthew, but I'm going to stick with a Reggie.
Oh, you are sticking with a Reggie.
I am sticking with a Reggie, and I don't know what the comics world has against Reggies, but the Reggie in this book is evil as well.
Yes, he is.
We're going to talk about Super Sons number 2. Now, this is a book that is written by Mr. Peter Tomasi. Jorge Jimenez does the artwork. Alejandro Sanchez does the colors. Rob Lee does the letters. And the editor on this one, it looks like Paul Kaminsky. This book is definitely not a lighthearted kids book.
No.
But it's also offering something that's really different from both Superman and Batman, and I kind of love it.
Yeah.
I will say this, that Peter Tomasi is nailing the chemistry between these two characters. Now, the last issue that we talked about, the first issue of this series, and I am behind on the series as well, was we saw this sort of scene where you had this kid, Reggie, this sort of who reminds me of, and I know this is a direct correlation to, and I'm going to have to ask him at some point, if I ever run into Peter Tomasi, I'm going to ask him about this. It's the Twilight Zone kid.
Yeah.
From the It's a Good Life episode.
We started out the first
little freckle-faced, yep, Ron Howard looking kid. That's who this is a nod to. And so what we saw in the first issue is that there was this kid who seemed to have almost like a terrifying amount of control over his family. And what it looked like is their little home looked like the set of a television show. So now in the second issue, and we just got a brief glimpse of them. So in the second issue, we have another prologue where you have the kid saying, "Ready or not, here I come." And you see the different members of this kid's family are hiding out around this set. And it still looks like a television set.
Yeah.
And they're hiding out in different rooms of it. And you see that the kid has split himself into three versions of himself. And they're all walking around and he's saying, "Who should I seek first? Mom, Dad, Archie, who is his brother, or maybe my little sister, the easiest one of all." And he's kind of sneaking around. And as he comes to each one of them and finds them, he brutally attacks them. And so he says to his dad, "So many options, like a big brother," he says to his brother Reggie, "who always thought he was better than me." And he starts to choke the guy. Then he goes over to his dad, "Or a dad who didn't think I measured up as a superhero." And he throws a TV on top of his dad. He comes up to his mom, "Or my good old mom, always there to protect me until she wasn't." And everybody, one by one, is getting seemingly murdered by this kid. And all of a sudden, you see the sister sort of run out into the night and run out of the building and out into the rain. So now we cut over to Metropolis, where you have Superboy and Robin, Damian and Jonathan, who are trying to break into LexCorp. because there was a break-in at LexCorp, and they believe that it has a clue to this case that they're on. So they're trying to break into LexCorp. Well, who shows up but Lex Luthor himself with the super armor that he wears? And there's kind of a great scene where he is kind of floating behind them. And I know you read this one too, Matt, where you have him floating behind him saying, so which one of you two is going to explain? And Jonathan is saying, oh, God, I'm in so much trouble. And Damien's like, this is perfect.
Yeah.
And what's awesome about that, and this is what I'm talking about in terms of the chemistry, you could tell that Peter Tomasi and Jorge Jimenez talked about this. And just this one page, you completely get the sort of annoyed attitude of Lex Luthor. You completely get the absolutely like just giving up because he's in so much trouble attitude of Jonathan, and the this is no big deal attitude of Damien. You totally get all that. And so what Damien does to distract Lex Luthor is he grabs Jonathan and flings him off the side of the building because he knows he can't fly. So Luthor is sitting there saying, this is a school night. Shouldn't you kids be at home? And he says, I want you off my building now. And Damien says, oh, if you say so. And he throws Jonathan and he says, by the way, the kid can't fly. And so Luthor has to go down and save him. And while he does that, Damien takes that opportunity to break into the building. So you have Jonathan falling and he has to be saved by Lex Luthor. They get down to the ground and Luthor is trying to lecture him. He's like, you've got a great deal of explaining to do. And Jonathan kind of fights him off. And he's like, we're not anybody. Leave us alone. And he's trying to get away from him. And while that skirmish is going on, Damien breaks into this sub-level of the building where he's looking around for clues. And he's like, knowing Kent's speed, I probably got 20 seconds at best. Let's use them wisely. And he's going on. So this was all part of his plan. He basically brought Jonathan along to cause a distraction if they ran into any trouble, because he looks at Superboy as kind of useless, except like as a tool to be. He's just another part of Damien's plan, which is so Damien, right? So you have Jonathan trying to get away from Luthor, and Jonathan saying, look, we broke out of our St. Mary's orphanage to meet the greatest hero of all, you, Mr. Superman guy with your armor. And he's like, oh, that's interesting. Then why is your friend currently planting explosives in my lab? Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. And so he drags Jonathan in there, and there's an explosive in there, and he blows it up, and he's like, that was your plan, an amateur explosive device? He's like, actually, he says, I'll give you two whelps to the count of three to tell me what's going on. And he says, actually, I'm going to give you to the count of five, Damien says. And he says, why is that? And Damien hits a button, and there's like 15 other devices in the room. So as Lex goes to deal with that, Damien and Jonathan escape. And when they get out of there, Jonathan is yelling at him saying, we didn't even get what we came for. And Damien's like, oh, we absolutely did. Don't worry about it. Those weren't explosive devices. He essentially bugged the place so that he could take data off of the computer in Lex's lab. And so he ends up doing that. And they kind of have a fight because Jonathan is saying, this is what you did. You just dragged me out here. You almost got me in trouble. And you just did that so I could be your distraction. So he's kind of bitter that Damien is just using him. But they start looking through the stuff that they've gotten from Luthor's lab. And that's where they find video of this kid, Reggie. And it turns out that this kid, Reggie, and his family were affected by the Amazo virus. Now, I didn't read this, but apparently this was in one of the other Superman books. It says the Amazo virus is a synthetic plague created by Luthor using the power-stealing android Amazo. It has diverse effects on its victims. Well, this family that we saw in the prologue and we saw in the first issue apparently was affected by this Amazo virus, and all of them got superpowers. But whatever's happened in the meantime, something has gone wrong with this kid, Reggie. It's affected him in a way where he's basically turned on his family now. So they see the video of this kid, and they track where the video came from to this warehouse where they get in there, and you see it's the warehouse where this television set was, where Reggie was there. And when they walk in and start looking around, Jonathan is the first one to see that this family has all been murdered. And so he's freaking out, saying, we need to get out of here right now. We need to call our parents. And Damien's like, no, we're not doing that. He's like, this is my case. I'm on it now. This is what we've been looking for. And Superboy chucks him across the room and says, you are crazy. People are dead. And he jumps out of the building and he goes, you know, he's going to go find his dad, basically. So he gets out of there. Damien's like, whatever, crybaby. My investigation is still going on. And Damien's kind of looking around and trying to find clues. But as he's in there, he's looking and he's saying, well, there's five chairs here, but there's only four bodies. And that's when you realize the sister got away.
Yep.
And who finds the sister in the woods but Jonathan? And as he does, you see that Batman is outside watching Jonathan as he stumbles across this girl. And you see that inside the building, as Damian is sifting through clues, Superman is standing behind them. So as this issue ends, the parents have shown up and things, I'm going to guess, are going to take a turn for trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way that that particular issue ends. As I mentioned before, I love the chemistry that these two characters have, because you have Jonathan, who's very unsure of his powers, still figuring things out, very much, and he's younger than Damian, and he's very much wanting to ask his dad for permission. He doesn't want to get in trouble. That's his main concern. I do not want to get in trouble, and I want to help people. And Damian has his own agenda. I'm going to show Batman that I don't need him. I'm going to show him that I can do this stuff on my own. I can solve mysteries and take down bad guys without anybody else's help. And I'm going to bring this kid along because he kind of has a soft spot for Jonathan, but also because he knows that he can use him.
And I think he's also realizing one day he is going to get his powers and right. He's going to need this kid. And I love the fact that the one that is the most powerful is not the most powerful yet.
Right.
And Damian, who has no powers at all, except he's a 10-year-old that can, you know, kick the crap out of most people and can get out of any situation, is the strongest of that two right now.
Yeah.
And does not have any moral compass.
No, at least not when it comes to – he's a very sort of ends justify the means yes. kind of kid. And it's – but it's a really entertaining series. And as I said – not a kid's book. So if you saw the title Super Sons and you were thinking, oh, this is going to be the kid version because the sons are going to be teaming up, which is kind of what I initially thought maybe it would be, that is not that at all. There is some pretty dark stuff going on in this book, but it's a very good read. So there you go. That's your new books for this week. And now it's time, Matthew, for us to kick off the Summer of Dread. You and I are both sitting here holding the Judge Dredd Complete Case Files 01. And what these omnibuses are is they're well over 300 pages each, and they are the earliest case files of Judge Dredd from 2000 AD. And so what we're going to be doing is we're going to be jumping into them. And today in this segment, we're going to go through – there's a few stories that are sort of standalone and varied – case files that you get in the beginning, and then it gets into the first sort of meaty, several strip long Judge Dredd story. So we're going to do those handful of one-offs today. That's what we're going to talk about. And before we get into it, just a quick history from our good friends at Wikipedia about Judge Dredd. For those of you who are not familiar at all with the character.
I was already with my information on Judge Dredd.
Oh, well, you go ahead, because you're probably better than Wikipedia.
Well, I was just going to talk about the basics. I mean, sure, it's going to be a deep thing, but 2000 AD was a newspaper-style comic book that was I believe it was weekly, then went to bi-weekly. I believe it started in either 1976 or 1977. And it was a place where you got a lot of science fiction in 1977. Later on, when Star Wars hit, it almost became like a little bit of a sci-fi magazine as well, where you were getting a lot of stuff. I have two or three issues of 2000 AD, and I remember being kind of put off when I got them because I'd unfold them. It's like, oh, it's like a newspaper. This is crazy.
Yep.
But this is where Judge Dredd got his birth, and Judge Dredd was one of like 30 or 40 characters that came out of 2000 AD, and when he was introduced, he was no more special than I think Dan Dare was one. You had Rogue Trooper later on. All these characters that came out of it, Judge Dredd was just another two or three page strip, and they were in black and white when they came out. I think they later went to go on color, but you would open it up, and it was a lot like when DC did that Wednesday Papers or the Wednesday Funnies. It was a lot like that, where you got a two or three page story of Judge Dredd, and then you waited till the next week to get the next one. And
right. At
first it started out as, you know, again, it was like, we don't know if this character is going to make it. So we're just going to give you kind of the quick origin story, but not really an origin story. Then we're going to give you two or three short stories. And then when you got a little bit more popular in the strip, you were given a cover
right. And
then maybe four or five pages in.
So just a quick background on sort of the creation of Judge Dredd. Judge Joseph Dredd is a fictional character who appears in the British comic books published by Rebellion Developments, as well as a number of movie and video game adaptations. He was created by writer John Wagner and artist Carlos Esquerra, and first appeared in the second issue of 2000 AD in 1977, a weekly science fiction anthology comic, he is the magazine's longest-running character. Dredd is a law enforcement officer in the dystopian future of Megacity 1 in North America. He's a street judge empowered to summarily arrest, convict, sentence, and execute criminals. In Great Britain, the character of Dredd and his name are sometimes invoked in discussions of police states, authoritarianism, and rule of law. When Pat Mills was developing 2000 AD in 1976, he brought in his former writing partner, John Wagner, to develop characters. Wagner had written various Dirty Harry-style tough cop stories for other titles and suggested a character who took that concept to its logical extreme. Mills had developed a horror strip called Judge Dredd after the British ska and reggae artist Alexander Minto Hughes, but abandoned the idea as unsuitable for the new comic, but the name, with the spelling modified to D-R-E-D-D, at the suggestion of sub-editor Kevin Gosnell, was adopted by Wagner. So that's kind of how the character kind of came together. The task of visualizing the character was given to Carlos Esquerra, a Spanish artist who had worked for Mills before on Battle Picture Weekly. Wagner gave Esquerra an advertisement for the film Death Race 2000.
Wow.
Because he looks like – it's Frankenstein, right?
Is
that the character that he looks like? Showing the character Frankenstein, played by David Carradine, clad in black leather on a motorbike as a suggestion of Dredd's appearance. Esquerra added body armor, zips, and change, which Wagner initially objected to. Wagner's initial script was rewritten by Mills and drawn up by Esquerra. The hardware and cityscapes Esquerra had drawn were far more futuristic than the near-future setting originally intended. So that's just a bit of the history of how that character came together. And we're going to jump in today, and we are reading. It's hard to kind of say like what pages to read each time. It will be a little bit easier after this one, which is why we're going to do the first few sort of short stories in the Judge Dredd case files today. Did you want to kick us off with the first one, Matthew?
So yeah, we can start out with this one. And what I love about this is that you are getting a very rough view of what would come later on from Judge Dredd. And again, you're only getting a couple of the stories, a couple of the tales. And to me, if you remember the Dredd movie that came out,
yep.
This is almost like the beginning of the Dredd movie.
Yes.
Where you've got a bunch of dudes waiting to just ambush some judges.
Yep.
You find out really early on that these people, and you see it's what, 2099
yes.
AD in New
Which
York.
Which I freaked out about, because obviously the 2099 universe at Marvel is one of my favorite universes. I did not realize it was initially set in 2099.
Yep. So these guys here have set up a trap, and you see that it's a really interesting little cityscape. The what Mega City would turn into later on, or New York, I should say, became Mega City 1, would later turn into, is a little bit different than what we have here. But you've got these guys that are like, oh, you know what? Let's wait. We just got a judge coming. Let's sabotage him, or let's ambush him. So you see the Judge Dredd's coming. You see him on his lawgiver motorcycle. And on the next page, you've got these three dudes. And one of them, it's interesting because he's looking like it's Strontum Dog, I think is the name of the character. But he's got a helmet that almost looks like what this guy would be wearing a few years later. So in this, you've got these guys, they're waiting, and they're like, oh, man, we hope it's Judge Dredd, because he's the worst of them all.
Right,
we hope
there's
it's
a judge
him.
Coming, we're going to kill him, let's hope it's Dredd.
Yep, so they shoot, they blow up the motorbike underneath him, he goes flying, he is now dead, and you find out that it is Judge Alvin.
Yep.
Judge Alvin was the one who gets it, and they're not too happy about that. They're happy they killed the judge. They're happy that they got his weapon, and now they're all proud of what they've done.
And they put him on his bike.
Yes.
And they put it on autopilot, so it takes him back to headquarters. And they pin a note on him that says, who are you going to send against me now, punks? Judge Whitey.
Yeah. So he's got the stuff. He's ready. And I remember when I first read this thinking that was pretty creepy that they put him back on the bike.
Well, right.
And sent them back there.
Plus, knowing what we know about Judge Dredd just from knowing the character, we're like, dude, why are you antagonizing Judge Dredd?
Yeah.
Like, he's the last guy in the world that you want to get mad at you.
And as you see when the bike shows up, you see, like, the body, like, leaning back in there, mouth wide open.
Yep.
And what I loved about this, too, was this was a lot like a Western. This is a lot like what you would see in weird Western
it
tales
is.
With Jonah
yes.
Hex.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Let's just put the dead dude back on the horse.
Yeah.
And send him back into town.
Send him back into town, exactly.
And they get there, and the first time that you really see Judge Dredd, he does not look the intimidating character that he would become.
No, he's not super bulky. He's yep. like pretty thin under that. I don't want to say scrawny, but yeah, yep. he's not. He doesn't cut a super imposing figure like right off the bat.
Like the armor isn't there. Like the shoulder blades where he's got those huge pads are not quite there. They're there. But what I always loved about these, the judges, is the badge. You've got this huge badge with a name on it and a chain that is holding it in place.
It connects right to their zipper.
To their zipper. Yeah. I freaking love that.
Yeah.
But you have the, you know, Judge Dredd's like, you know what? They've met their match on this one. So he takes off. And as he goes over to go find these guys, it's really funny because Whitey has got his mask on. He's got the Judge Alvin's mask, which is a weapon in itself. So as they're waiting for Judge Dredd to show up, the lawgiver goes by. They're waiting and waiting and waiting, and it just goes by without Judge Dredd. So Dredd turns around in the back, and this was an interesting one too, because normally you don't see Judge Dredd later on be as acrobatic as he is here. Like they start shooting at him when he comes up behind him, and he hits the floor and does kind of this tuck roll. Then he gets up and shoots him.
Right.
He doesn't do that later on because he's so armored up.
Right.
And it's almost like an intimidation thing. Like, you know what? I'm standing right in front of you. I triple dog dare you to try to shoot me. So he takes these guys out. And that is when you see what he does. He will deliver the judgment right there. And this guy, thank God it's Judge Dredd's first appearance, because all he got was life.
And here's the place where he drops him off. Devil's Island, a huge traffic island in the middle of a vast inner city highway complex. So it's basically this platform
yeah.
in the middle of the super highways where tankers and stuff are going by at, like, I want to say 200 miles an hour.
Says speed limit, 250.
Right. So basically it's like dropping you off in the middle of the highway.
Yeah.
There's nowhere for you to go
yep.
because if you tried to go anywhere, you would get completely destroyed and run over, and you are constantly surrounded by the sound of all of this traffic whizzing by you a bunch of and so this guy gets dropped off, and one of the guys there says, "Ain't no escape from Devil's Island, man. Those 200-mile-an-hour monsters never stop. You're here for life, just like the rest of us." And the guy's like half crazy.
Yep. And then you've got the boss of it, that this is not the – I forgot what they call it, what they call
him. Oh,
later
they call
on.
Him the – I will tell you right now, the Grand Judge.
Yeah, so yeah. That's sort of a play. I think he's
like the chief.
He's like the chief. He's the commissioner. And he's over there talking about the sentence, you know, that was a stern sentence. You did what you had to do. But again, this is interesting because later on, Judge Dredd is going to be killing people.
And
all
the
over
best
the place.
Part is the grand judge is like, sometimes I think we're all going to go like Alvin Dredd. And he says, maybe, but in my book, that's the only way to go in defense of the law.
Yep.
So I love that as a first story because it's a very simple setup, but it does just make it abundantly clear. This is all this guy cares about.
Yeah.
He is there to enforce the law. And that's all. The book of law is the Bible to him, Matthew.
Yep. Yep.
Any crime committed is a sin.
And the interesting thing, again, is I think when I discovered this character a few years, well, so it would be probably 82, 83, because of the band Heavy Petton, and then later on because of Anthrax.
Yes.
When I discovered Judge Dredd, I discovered a character that was very much like Jonah Hex, the character that I
for sure
love forever.
Yeah, Jonah Hex is the Wild West Judge Dredd.
Yeah, that's exactly
so, yeah,
what
if
he
you,
is.
If you, that's true. If you like Jonah Hex, you will love this. The second story we get stars a criminal by the name of Scarface Levine.
Yes.
Who is this guy who, as you might imagine by his name, has got a pretty scarred up face. He's on the run for multiple murders, and Dredd gets a call that he's in the area. Well, Scarface Levine pulls up to this place called The New You, Instant Genetic Surgery. And he pulls up and he's like, I'm getting myself a new face. Once I get a new face put on, they'll never even recognize what's going on. So he says, you know, I'm fed up with my ugly mug. Can you give me a completely new image? And the woman's like, yeah, there's plenty of room for improvement. Follow me to one of our face booths. Please bring your authorization papers, because you have to have papers
yes.
in order to be able to get this surgery. And of course, he gets back there and he says, look, I ain't got no papers, but my gun should convince you. Let's move. And so she gives the guy a new face. And as he drives away, he's driving away, and Judge Dredd is driving down the highway.
Yep.
And he decides, cops aren't going to know who I am now. So he rides right up next to Judge Dredd. He's like, hi, Judge. Weather control's working fine, huh? Going to be a great day. And Judge Dredd says, yes, citizen. And then he notices that Judge Dredd is now following him. And he's like, I could put some distance between us. Gun this buggy up to 200 miles an hour. Dredd doesn't give a crap. He guns his own motorcycle, which is called the Lawmaster, and comes up right alongside the guy,
yes.
Jumps on top of his car, shoots through the rooftop, and basically sends this guy careening off the road and crashing. And he jumps back on his bike, Dredd does, turns around, comes and grabs this guy out of the wreck. And the guy's like, okay, it's time stretcher jail for me now, but, you know, can you grant me one request? And Dredd's like, the law can show mercy too. Speak. And he's like, how did you know it was me? And he says, when you spoke, your voice print matched the one sent to me by control. Just like fingerprints, everybody's voice is different. All lawbreakers' voice prints are on file at Justice HQ. When will lawbreakers learn? In the 21st century, no one can escape justice.
Yes.
And that's how that one ends.
And I keep calling the motorcycle the lawgiver. It's the lawmaster. The lawgiver
is the gun.
Is the gun.
Yes, correct.
So everything, like, he has just tons of weapons everywhere. And what I really loved about this story, which was interesting, was in the Logan's Run movie,
uh-huh.
There's the place called New You that will give you a new face.
Well, and in the Spider-Man storyline recently, it was New You Technologies.
Yep.
That was the that was basically growing people's organs and stuff like that. The next story involves a group called the Brotherhood of Darkness, who are basically like a cult, and they've been kidnapping people, and they've been fighting judges all over the place. And Dredd has been trying to figure out where this cult, where they're located at, where this cult, their main base is, and he's trying to figure out how he can infiltrate them. And so my favorite part of this one is that he takes down one of these cultists. And apparently these guys, the Brotherhood of Darkness, they don't like the light.
Oh, they don't like the light.
So Dredd decides that he's going to grab one of their robes and come in disguised. But the dude never takes his helmet off, and that's what I love about it. He literally grabs one of these guys' robes and puts it on over his helmet.
Yep.
He's still got his helmet on, and he follows these guys in. And when somebody questions him, he's like, hey, help me load this judge's bike on back of one of the trucks that we captured. And they're like, oh, great job. You got one of the judge's bikes. Yeah. So he basically gets a free ride into the enemy camp. And it's kind of cool because as they're driving through, it's a very sort of Mad Max, almost sort of, kind of wasteland sort of thing.
The big praying mantis.
The big praying mantis.
Yeah.
Like that, you know, right alone. You have Dredd saying, grief, that the atomic radiation's even affected the insects out here. That praying mantis must be 40 meters tall. So, yeah, I guess you want to stick to the city, for crying out loud. So this one is pretty cut and dry. He ends up getting into the encampment for this particular cult and ends up freeing the prisoners that they have there. And when he gets surrounded by them, he puts his high beams on from his lawmaster and ends up blinding them and taking them down. And that's how he takes down this crew. So that story is pretty short and sweet. But the next one, Matthew, is one of your favorites. And it's probably my favorite, too, of the early stories of Judge Dredd. And I'll let you kick that one off.
Interesting, before we move on to that story, this is sort of the first time that I think, like, and you look at this story, Mega City 1 is mentioned.
Yep.
And you now understand and realize that outside of the city limits, there is a wasteland out there.
Right.
So now you're understanding, okay, so some bad things had happened in between the time of me reading this and the Judge Dredd stories to the world. So we start out – now, this is one that is very much a nod to movie monsters and stuff
Absolutely.
Like that. Absolutely. So people are getting killed and people are dying, but they're dying in some really weird ways. And – they're seeing, like, they come to a body and they're like, wow, this thing got destroyed. It's sort of like a monster did it. And then, you know, Judge Dredd's thinking, well, no monster's above the law. I'm going to go take care of this
one. Yeah, I don't care what it is.
And you find out that it is basically a special effects museum that is creating these monsters to go out and do some damage.
Right. It's a guy who basically, and when the when the thing first starts, you have you meet Judge Dredd's, I think it's his.
Oh, it's his housemate. It's his
cleaning lady.
Yeah, and the other guy with him.
And the best part is it starts off and it says, the judges, America's lawmen, you know, of the 21st century have little spare time. Given a few minutes to relax, you would find Judge Dredd in his apartment reading his law books.
Yeah.
However, he looks up from reading his law books and there's like a jungle around him in his apartment and he's like, what the crap is this? And all of a sudden you have this guy come over and say, I'm a salesman from SensorRound.
That's right.
And he's like, I sell these devices that basically will transport. It's almost like virtual reality.
Yeah.
It'll transport you to wherever you want. And Judge's like, turn it off. Get that crap out of here before I arrest you. And so his cleaning lady is like, you don't have any fun, Judge. What's wrong with you?
You never enjoy yourself.
Yeah, she's kind of a –
I think it's an Irish accent.
Yeah, she's kind of a stereotype there. Yes. And he's basically saying, you know, maybe I should get a robot cleaner for crying out loud because this isn't worth it.
Yeah.
This is kind of infringing on my spare time. So yeah, as you said, he ends up tracking down the person who he believes is responsible for – these attacks, and it turns out that the guy who was pretending to be a salesman at his house is an old school movie guy
who's just pissed that nobody wants to watch monster movies.
Yeah, it's basically like he's mad that everybody went to CG instead of practical effects. I'm down with this guy.
Much like you.
This could be me.
I thought that was you.
This guy's basically saying, yeah, I'm going to make people appreciate this type of effect now because I'm going to use it to kill people.
Yeah. So as Dredd is chasing this guy around the museum after he finally captures him, or he corners him, I should say, he goes around a corner and lo and behold, it is Krong, the greatest film monster ever made, which is King Kong.
He basically has to fight King Kong.
It's like 300 feet tall and Krong is just destroying stuff, trying to get to Judge Dredd. Judge shooting at him. The bullets are bouncing off of him. He gets on the motorcycle and starts going at him and just shooting and shooting. And as he gets closer, he starts throwing he starts shooting grenades and stuff into his mouth. And then the thing blows up. And as it starts to kind of sway and get ready to fall, it falls on the guy who created him, thus being destroyed by his own creation.
All your dreams were crushed, O'Neill. But with dreams like yours, who needs nightmares?
It's right up there with It Was Beauty That Killed the Beast.
Yep.
This is such good stuff.
It's awesome, dude. And the best part about all these stories is like if you don't like a particular one, it's like three pages, dude.
Yep.
So then we go to the next one and it involves a villain by the name of Frankenstein 2. And he is a guy who is basically giving body parts to new people. And it says, Megacity 1 transplant surgery was perfected and people could almost live forever, so it was banned. But for some lawbreakers, they go in for illegal transplant surgery, which explains why this ambulance is being hijacked. So there's a group of thugs that are hijacking an ambulance that has either someone who's dying or dead in it, and they are taking it to their boss, who is Frankenstein 2. And you have Judge Dredd show up, and the woman who got kicked out of the ambulance, the family member, is like, you were here the whole time. You could have stopped him. And he's like, I'm sorry, nurse. Oh, it's a nurse. But I got to bust this whole operation. So he decides to let them go only to be able to follow them back to Frankenstein's hideout. And again, we get to see the Lawmaster in action here because he uses his cannons on the Lawmaster to just basically mow down a bunch of the thugs that work for this guy, Frankenstein. And he also uses his gun and the explosive bullet from his gun to basically shoot open the secret entrance to this guy's place. He goes in there. He ends up meeting up with this guy, Frankenstein, and this guy tries to attack him, and he ends up disarming him very easily, and the guy surrenders, and he ends up taking it in, and then he has the patient there who was getting, I want to say, like a head transplant or something like that, and the guy's like, you can't arrest me, Judge. I had a transplant, but what crime did I commit? Receiving stolen goods.
And that is the best because you know what? The guy could have been completely innocent of like, I didn't know where these things came from.
Yeah.
But you know what? Judge Dredd doesn't care.
Nobody's
because
innocent.
Ignorance is no excuse.
Exactly.
And as you go through a lot of these stories, like this one too, you start to see like the British comics had a ton of crazy awesome ideas that although like you think about this thing where you're creating and getting you're getting body parts and helping keeping people alive forever. This was a concept that 3-4 years later would be central to the Micronauts comic that would come out a year later, a few years later with the body banks.
Right.
So you have this stuff that I'm cracking up and reading these things going, you have got this freaking amazing concept. 3 pages, 4 pages, you're done with it.
Yep.
And on to the next one.
Right. And soon these things will start to be strung together. But the next one where you see, and this is where I kind of like how this is coming together. So in the next one, you see that there in New York, there has been a statue erected of a judge. And it's bigger than the Statue of Liberty.
Yes.
It's the Liberty Statue. Now, I think, is that what it's called? The Statue of Judgment.
Statue of Judgment.
That's what it's called. The Statue of Judgment. And you have all of these judges that are hanging out around this thing. And you have people, much like they would with the Statue of Liberty, who have walked up inside the statue.
Inside the
eye.
And
it says, at the top, in the eye of the judge, you have a bunch of guys fighting. Or they're looking down and they're seeing a fight happening and judges are getting attacked and things like that. So Judge Dredd ends up showing up and these guys start taking a shot at him. He jumps off the bike. He ends up taking these guys down. And one of the guys ends up getting away in a taxi. And so there's crowds on the street. This was supposed to be a big celebration. And these guys pretty much ruined it. And you have this guy running away in this taxi that he stole saying, judges, I hate them. And all they stand for. And the judge is like, you think in the 21st century we could wipe out crime, but I guess there will always be punks like you.
Yes.
So this guy takes off and Judge Dredd has to track him down and he ends up taking a shot at this guy who is escaping on this taxi and blowing up the vehicle that the guy took off on where he ends up falling and getting impaled on one of the spikes of the Statue of Liberty's crown, basically, and gets impaled on it.
So in the next story... we are getting closer to the big robot war, but this is the first one, I believe, and I'm trying to find it through, but I can't see it if it is or right. This is the first Brian Bolland art.
Because
if you notice right away, you go from a very rough style, and I believe that that is I'm trying to draw the guy who helped create it. Carlos
Esguerra.
Yeah, I believe that is his. And he's the one that gave basically the real look. But Bolland is the one who came in and absolutely just blew this strip right out of the water. So much that he was the one who drew the first 20 or 30 issues of the original series when it went to comics. Which is what I love about this. I mean, you now get a very streamlined look. And if you've noticed too, Brian, the logo has always been the same since page one.
Well, and we also learned something very important about Judge Dredd here because this particular one is about a thief who is stealing cars.
Yes.
That are in vintage condition from, you know, the 1900s. And so he steals this antique Morris. This antique Morris miner is worth 500,000 credits. And he ends up murdering one of the people that he steals the car from. So this thief then takes it to a chop shop. And you have Dredd sort of tracking him down. And Dredd saying, you know, the lawbreaker shall lead me to the rest of his gang and Mr. Big. Mm-hmm. So this is like the guy that he works for that he's kind of finding him from. And you see that this car thief ends up taking this car he stole down to the chop shop. And he's saying, I got a beauty for you this time, boys, a British car, 140 years old and not a scratch on it. And like, oh, that's great. You know, the collectors will pay top dollar as soon as we've disguised it. So they end up using this gun that like sprays plastic
yep.
over it. So they change the appearance of the car without damaging it so that they can then sell it to a collector without getting caught. But of course, Judge Dredd shows up and when he does, they try to shut the door on him. He just blows the door up and he comes walking in and one of the guys sprays this plastic all over Judge Dredd's helmet.
Yep.
Basically to try and blind him. And Dredd takes off his helmet. And that's where you see the rest of the guys freak out. Because they say, what's happened to Dredd's face? It's horrible. With a face like that, Dredd shouldn't be allowed to live. We have to kill him. So apparently under that helmet, which he never takes off yep. in the comics, he is like horribly scarred or something like that, which goes right back to Jonah Hex,
yeah.
as we talked about before.
Yep.
So there are definitely some parallels here. Now, when was Jonah Hex created?
73, 74.
So we're 77 here, yep. right? So you're seeing some of the parallels there. So it's kind of like... Judge Dredd is almost like Jonah Hex and Dirty Harry
yes.
put together. You know what I mean? And he ends up this one is kind of stupid in how it ends because he takes out all the thugs and then this guy is going to get away from him, the head boss,
Mr. Big guy,
and he jumps on the people mover
that you see
at the airport,
yeah.
like the conveyor belt. And he's like, you'll never catch me, Dredd. I'm on the high-speed walk-easy. And
wait
he starts
a minute.
Going away. Judge Dredd just has the controls reversed, so the guy ends up flying back to him, and he ends up taking him in.
And he's saying as he's getting closer, why am I getting closer to you?
I'm running backwards. What's happening? Towards Judge Dredd. He says, yes, lawbreaker. I ordered the walk-easy to be put in reverse, something that must never happen to the law. And that's the way that ends. So that's your first group of stories.
Yeah, great stuff.
In the Judge Dredd Complete Case Files. And again, if you haven't had a chance to get your hands on this yet, you can get this for like $15 on Amazon. You can also get the digital version for like $10 on DriveThru Comics. If you go to the Secret Identity website, there are links to both of those where you can go and pick this up. But this is our summer reading project. It is the summer of Dredd, Matthew.
It is.
And we're going to be making our way through. And in the next episode, we're going to talk about the first real major storyline that runs through Judge Dredd, which is the Robot Wars. And that will be our topic for the next segment. But that is going to wrap up this particular installment of the Summer of Dredd. That is also going to wrap up this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but DriveThru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, DriveThru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets DriveThru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to DriveThruComics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.